Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is yet another mystery case, the intersection between exercise and medicine. And I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. Are you ready for this?
I'm excited.
you shouldn't be. You shouldn't be. I took a cue from the last mystery case that we did where you just challenged me, honestly. You're like, can you find something a little crazier? And I did. I had to do some digging and I found something. This is honestly, I've said it a couple times before, where I don't think you'll get this one.
I think you just previously failed to have sufficient context or like recognition of like what I do with my time.
I know what you do. Okay. If you're listening at home and you've listened to the mystery cases before, I have full appreciation for not only Dr. Baracchi's diagnostic skills and his fund of knowledge, but also I think on the flip side of that, I can't present to you a case that has so little information and so little like, you know, things for you to diagnose, to go off diagnosis, that it's just no fun. And you're like, I have no idea, dude. Like, this makes no sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of information on this particular one, which will require a decent amount of explanation and summarizing for the audience. So like, look, if you don't really like the mystery cases, I implore you, just hear this one out. You're going to learn some stuff. It'll be useful information. I promise you at some point in your life. And you get to hear Dr. Baracchi's thought process, which I actually think is more applicable to things outside of medicine as well. Just how you think about things, how you reason through things, and just that approach.
All right. Interesting. Let's go.
But before we get into that, any updates for the listeners? People do like the happy talk, you know. Your mom in particular. Your mom joke, but like she said, my favorite part of the podcast. That's also not how your mom sounds. That's just my traditional mom voice. She said that my favorite part of the podcast is when you and Austin are just talking. Sometimes I listen to it while I work out. I'm like, we got to find you. Like, do you like music,
yeah,
Mrs. Baracchi? Like, do you?
Adorable.
Totally. Meanwhile, Leonard is like, I tell everyone to listen to your podcast. I'm like, that's my dad. And he goes, I tell everyone to listen to your podcast. I'm like, do you listen to it, Dad? And he goes, well, no, of course not. And I was like, nice.
Yeah, no, things are going all right with work, with training. I guess we're also sitting here on election eve. And so trying to keep our sanity through this next 36 to who knows how many long hours.
Yeah.
Process.
Yeah.
What happens.
Yeah. I mean, we've gotten some requests, or at least I have certainly in my DMs. I know you don't check your DMs as frequently as I do, but you know, people want to talk about the Make America Healthy Again initiative. People want to talk about various claims for people involved in that. And like, should we just do a big Quack Watch segment? And I don't know. I think there's already enough polarizing stuff out there. And further, I'm not sure that a review of like scientific literature to address specific claims is particularly convincing to anyone who is kind of on that side, so to speak. And I don't mean that in a, you know, negative manner. It's just like, look, if you really followed scientific evidence, you'd kind of end up at the same position that most of the healthcare providers and scientists and researchers are on. So I'm not sure how useful that is of our time. And so maybe we'll just talk about squat mechanics instead. Like, I think that might be a better option.
You know, despite our general pessimism, you know, historically about having, you know, debates with people and quote unquote trying to change their mind, which, you know, how often I have often recommended that book that people read, how minds change. But the podcast by that author, he recently had an episode that kind of shifted me into a little bit more optimistic direction. So I think it was within the past week or two, he interviewed some researchers who they used a ChatGPT-based large language model and trained it on a set of well-known kind of conspiracy theories. And they called it DebunkBot. And so he did an interview with these researchers because they apparently tested this large language model, effectively chatbot, with people who were able to interact with it. And you can too. That's why I'm bringing it up at all right now. You can Google DebunkBot, go on the website, and you can have a discussion with this chatbot about various ideas. And they found that this thing was able to have pretty massive effects on shifting people's beliefs, you know, when in these discussions, because for a variety of interesting reasons, like they're not debating with another person, because person to person conversations can get contentious and your pride can get hurt and get defensive. And this is just like a neutral chatbot. It also never runs out of energy. It also has access to the entire internet to handle any challenges or claims or evidence. It was really interesting to hear about. And so I'm just, it's something that sparked a little bit of optimism for the potential use of these things in the future, as opposed to the traditional doom and gloom about, you know, the internet as this unchecked Wild West that's going to inexorably get worse. It's like, well, maybe there's a little bit of some light there.
Hey, well, there you go. That's a perfect segue. I've been poking around with developing the Barbell Medicine chatbot. Effectively a language, a language learning model just restricted to what we've published, where people could ask questions and it would come up with the quote barbell medicine answer. I'm still obviously doing some development and trying to figure out like, hey, is this okay to put out there? Because I have concerns about not only what people will ask that, but also the range of answers, but we'll see. So maybe that is something that'll be useful. So, all right. I like your optimism. Speaking of optimism, we have a few new items on the website, in particular, the Power Building 1 Generation 2 template. We did. It's not just an update. It's a whole new template. So look, you know, the holidays are kind of right around the corner. People need options to train, whether it's do we have a 2-day template built in there, a 3-day template, 4-day template, a bunch of adjustability in there. So if you're looking for a new training template, that is available on our website, also on our app. So you can look that up. And then look, if you hate the ads at the beginning of this podcast, hey, I don't like them either. We're trying to figure out a way to support what we do here at Barbell Medicine. And so we have our Barbell Medicine Plus membership, where you get ad-free listening, early access to podcasts, exclusive content, including new episodes or exclusive episodes, video content, summaries, et cetera. We're going to keep building that out. So if you want to support what we do here at Barbell Medicine, you can find that in the link in the description below. All right, preamble aside, it's mystery case time. If this is your first Barbell Medicine mystery case, thank you for sitting through our happy talk. We're going to get into the meat of this podcast. Basically, what I do is I present a case report that has been published in the scientific literature. So it's a real person, real case. All the details about this are real. And then I go piece by piece. Dr. Baraki explains how he's thinking about this from a medical standpoint. And we're going to tie this into exercise, not only because the case started during exercise, but also in like, if you have a client with this particular diagnosis, what do with them and what are the potential benefits, potential risks, some clinical pearls about training folks with this particular diagnosis at the end. So I have to make the prediction, will you get this? And I think you know where I stand on this particular one. I think it's unlikely. I'm giving you even odds, which I think are the worst odds that I've placed on you so far, only because I believe in you. You've done a great job so far. So let's pop in to this mystery case. 60-year-old female presents to an outpatient cardiology clinic for shortness of breath while exercising on a treadmill that's gotten worse over the last 2 weeks. In particular, she's had more frequent shortness of breath over the last few days, where it's happened basically during any type of exertion. And she notes that the shortness of breath does resolve with rest. She denies any chest pain, any palpitations. She doesn't have any swelling in the legs. She has no coughing or shortness of breath while lying down or sleeping. And she denies any recent weight change or lightheadedness. She also has no smoking history. She denies recreational drug use or having previous episodes like this. She does have a pretty extensive medical history, however. She's got a 10-year history of type 2 diabetes. She's on metformin, glucagon, and dulaglutide. She also has high blood pressure. She's on bisoprolol. She has high cholesterol. She's on atorvastatin. She also has a 5-year history of asymptomatic pulmonary sarcoidosis that is stable per recent CT evaluation, and she's currently not on any treatment because she's asymptomatic. She had a coronary angiography, which for the listeners at home is an X-ray-powered picture of the blood vessels of the heart that showed a 40 to 50% narrowing of the left anterior descending artery, but she's otherwise asymptomatic. So with that sort of history, any thoughts on this particular patient, Dr. Baraki?
Yeah. So to summarize, we have a 60-year-old woman with metabolic syndrome, untreated sarcoidosis of the lung, which is an autoimmune condition that can involve the lungs, the skin, lots of other areas of the body. And then she has some known coronary artery disease, but that's not terribly severe. So that's the background of this patient. And then what we'll call the foreground, what's going on right now, is a 2-week history of shortness of breath with exertion. And you gave me a whole bunch of symptoms that she doesn't have that are also kind of useful, but not necessarily able to fully rule certain things out. So solving the problem of shortness of breath is one of the most common symptoms that I see on a day-to-day basis and teach about and kind of work through. And overwhelmingly, the vast majority of causes of shortness of breath are going to relate to either the heart or the lungs. A tiny fraction are going to be due to other causes like anemia, for example, or thyroid issues or pregnancy or certain medications or just, you know, anxiety, panic attacks, things like that. But the vast majority relate to the heart and the lungs. And that's reinforced here by the fact that her shortness of breath is exertional, meaning that it gets worse when she exerts herself and it gets better with rest. And so the way I think about any symptom that is exertional is, what are all the things that we need in order to exert ourselves? We need muscles. They need blood supply and sufficient oxygenated, you know, hemoglobin delivery. And we need a heart that can pump that blood effectively. And we need lungs that can deliver oxygen to that blood. So we need all those things to work in concert to allow us to exert ourselves. And if any of those things kind of are going wrong in any particular way, then that kind of lesion, we'll call it, area that's broken can lead the person to be unable to exert themselves normally. So maybe their performance might go down. They might have a harder time completing tasks that used to be easy for them. They might get short of breath and have to stop prematurely. So I'm currently working under the framework that this is most likely going to end up being a problem either related to her heart or her lungs, while in the background maintaining the possibility that, hey, I just need to probably check a hemoglobin, check a thyroid test, a couple other less common things that we might be dealing with. And then as far as how I work through the possibilities of, is this more related to the heart or the lungs? In her case, she has strong reasons for both. She has metabolic syndrome that can accelerate heart disease. She's 60 years old. That's a prime demographic to develop heart disease. But she also has this history of known sarcoidosis of the lung, an autoimmune condition that can impact the lungs pretty significantly and lead to both lung disease and a lot of other complications outside those organs. So both of these are possible. When I'm working through them individually, heart problems, I kind of work through based on the anatomy of the heart. Could she have a problem with her coronary arteries? Well, we know she has some, but 40 to 50% narrowing of the left anterior descending artery is not really enough to do this. Could she have other problems with her coronaries? Totally. I'll leave those aside for now. Could she have problems with the valves of her heart? Certainly. Could she have problems with the muscle of her heart and be developing heart failure? That's also possible. Although some of the symptoms you told me make me think that's a little bit less likely. For example, she's not gained weight. She doesn't have swelling in her legs. She's not short of breath when she lies down. So I've covered the coronaries, the valves, the muscle of the heart. Could she have a problem with the pericardium around her heart? That's also a possible area, like fluid accumulation in that space or pericarditis, for example, although that would usually come with chest pain. And then there's the aorta that attaches to the heart. Could there be a problem with the aorta, an aneurysm, something like that, causing a valvular problem? There's various ways that we could get there. So that's the heart. I'm going to be investigating that using something like an electrocardiogram, an EKG. She's likely to end up getting an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of her heart along the way, some blood tests looking for evidence of injury to the heart, as well as a few other things. And then with the lungs, I'll similarly work through it based on the anatomy of the lungs. There could be something going on with her airways. Common examples of that would be something like asthma, COPD, That doesn't entirely fit what's going on here, but something like that's possible. The actual, what we call the parenchyma, the lung tissue itself, can become scarred, fibrotic. Sarcoidosis can involve that tissue. The alveoli, or the little pockets that fill with air to deliver oxygen into the blood, those can get filled with stuff. They can collapse. There can be problems like pneumonia that impact that. And then finally, there's the pleura, the lining of the lungs around the outside, where fluid can accumulate, causing shortness of breath, or you can get a collapsed lung. And then the blood vessels of the lungs themselves, you can get pulmonary hypertension, so high blood pressure in your lungs, or blood clots in your lungs, pulmonary emboli or pulmonary vasculitis. Those vessels can get inflamed. So to summarize what I just did, I just went through all the little anatomic parts of both the heart and the lungs and thought about what common conditions can impact those and lead to shortness of breath. As far as the heart, I mentioned what I would like to do to evaluate that. As far as her lungs go, she's going to ultimately end up needing some imaging up front. So this is most likely going to involve a chest x-ray or a chest CT scan. And then in some situations, we end up trying to get things like pulmonary function testing and things like that, although that's not at the forefront of my decision-making at this immediate time. So that's kind of where I'm starting with this case. There is, as you mentioned, a pretty enormous list of possibilities that could be going on, but that's where I'm focusing my initial thought process.
All right. Well, ask and ye shall receive. So let's start off with some vital signs here on her exam and laboratory assessment. So she's afebrile, no fever. Her blood pressure is slightly elevated, 130 over 70. Her heart rate is 50 beats per minute. She's sitting 97% on room air. On physical exam, the patient is alert and oriented. She appears to be well nourished with no signs of distress. Her head and neck exam were both normal with no jugular venous distension noted. Her heart rate was regular with no murmurs, rubs, or gallops. She did have an occasional premature beat that was detected on auscultation, so listening to it with a stethoscope. Her peripheral pulses were present and equal on both sides. No edema was noted in the legs. Her lung exam, lung sounds were clear. No accessory muscles of inspiration were noted. Her abdominal exam was also normal. She has no lesions on the skin exam either. Motor exam was also normal. We move on to labs. She had a whole battery of labs that were ordered, as you might expect. So a complete metabolic panel, a CBC, cardiac enzymes, as you mentioned, thyroid labs, and also flow cytometry labs were also ordered.
Okay.
Mostly normal labs, no anemia, for example, on a CBC. She had normal potassium. She had normal ultrasensitive troponin. That's some of those cardiac labs you had alluded to. Normal thyroid function. Normal angiotensin converting enzyme levels is kind of an evaluation of her pulmonary sarcoidosis diagnosis from before. And her flow cytometry results were also normal. In fact, the only thing that her labs were significant for was an elevated hemoglobin A1C to 6.7%, whereas normal is in the 4 to 6% range. She had an electrocardiogram done. So again, looking at the electrical activity within the heart, showed a prolonged PR interval and prolonged QTC at 450 milliseconds. Her chest x-ray of the lungs was unchanged from previous imaging, consistent with pulmonary sarcoidosis. So she had some bilateral hilar adenopathy, but otherwise unchanged from previous imaging. She had a cardiac ultrasound done as well. Again, as you mentioned, showed a wall motion abnormality within the basal septal akinesia of the left ventricle, although her ejection fraction was preserved. Left and right chambers were normal size. She had a normal ascending aorta size and aortic valve function. Okay. There's some more laboratory workup and imaging to come, but before I go any further, you want to summarize this patient and any change in your thought process here?
Yeah. So her vitals are mostly okay, except a heart rate of 50, which does get my attention for sure. You also didn't tell me any medications that she's on. For example, if she's on a beta blocker or anything like that.
She's on bisoprolol.
Bisoprolol. You did mention that. Excuse me. Okay. And then her physical exam is pretty boring, mostly reassuring stuff. No evidence of heart failure on her exam, and her lungs sounded clear when you listened. And so not a ton of signal on her exam to point me in any particular direction, just stuff that would point me away from certain things. And then on her labs, again, you mentioned a whole bunch of normal things. It's unclear to me why they did a flow cytometry. There's probably something there that I didn't know about. And then the ACE level is kind of useless for sarcoidosis. It's not a good test, and I wouldn't use it or pay attention to it. On the electrocardiogram, that's not terribly surprising findings. although when you told me her heart rate was 50, and that immediately got me suspicious of sarcoidosis getting into her heart. And so that's something that can certainly happen, where sarcoidosis not only can affect the lungs, but it can get into the heart, it can get into the conduction system, and basically impact the electrical wiring of your heart and prevent you from being able to increase your heart rate, or you can develop things like heart block, where your heart chambers don't talk to each other. And that could certainly lead to this type of a presentation where she gets shortness of breath with exertion. And she doesn't really have any other findings of heart failure, no chest pain, all these other things that could certainly be due to an electrical issue in her heart. So I'm a little suspicious of that. And in this situation, I would immediately back off on the bisoprolol. That should not be the best choice for her to be taking for her blood pressure anyway, but her heart rate is a little too low. And so that's really the main signal that I have to rely on. And then the echocardiogram of her heart showing some akinesis of a couple segments of her heart wall muscle, meaning that that muscle has probably experienced either, most commonly would be due to a prior heart attack, and that muscle has been kind of damaged and is and never fully recovered function. Although her heart overall seems to be functioning okay, and reassuringly, her valves are good, which is one question that I had, and her aorta looks okay. So at this point in time, the only real signal that I have is with the electrical system of her heart. The coronaries, the muscle have been evaluated, the pericardium, the valves have been assessed, her hemoglobin for anemia has been assessed, and then her chest x-ray is unchanged from prior, although the chest x-ray is not the best test to assess for a few different things in the lungs. And so I'd be curious whether, in addition to maybe looking into this heart rate and potentially rhythm issue, she might need more than just a 10-second electrocardiogram. She might need more prolonged electrical monitoring of her heart. Whether any other imaging of her lungs was done, for example, a chest CT, potentially that could have been contrasted to look at the blood vessels in her lungs, or whether there was any assessment, for example, or if there's any, you didn't mention any evidence on her echocardiogram of pulmonary hypertension, but that would be another thing I'd be curious about.
Yeah. When I was reading through this case report, I was like, some of these labs are a little sus, like the flow cytometry. I was like, I don't know why they ordered that, but yeah, you know, maybe I'm not supposed to know. And then I was like, I wonder why they did a chest x-ray instead of a pulmonary CT, or why not both, you know, for example. Yeah. Cause at this point, you know, you're kind of thinking like, why do you have these symptoms, and more so, why are you here if everything's normal? Kind of strange. So let's give you some more information, see if you can come up with a diagnosis. Okay. So they actually had her do a submaximal exercise test, which was stopped at 2 minutes into the test, which is about 67% of her maximal predicted heart rate due to palpitations that she had. No chest pain or syncope, just she said she noticed some palpitations. And after that, it was followed by a self-limited run of polymorphic ventricular tachycardia and QT interval prolongation. At the time, her blood pressure was 152 over 70. But yeah, she had no chest pain, no feelings of lightheadedness. Effectively, she failed the submaximal exercise test because she couldn't get all the way through it. But that's what happened. In any case, they decided, look, you're in the cardiology clinic. We're going to send you to the hospital. We're going to admit you. We're going to work you up further. And actually, they increased her bisoprolol to 5. She was at 2.5 before. Mm-hmm. And they discontinued her dulaglutide. So for some unknown reason, they didn't comment on that further. So she was admitted to the hospital. She got a diagnostic coronary angiography that showed stable plaque in the left anterior descending artery, again, with 40 to 50% stenosis or narrowing. Cardiac monitoring on hospital day one showed several ectopic supraventricular beats and intermittent blockage of conduction between the atria and ventricle, with gradual PR interval prolongation and subsequent P wave non-conduction. At this time, a cardiac MRI was performed, which showed an ejection fraction of 45%, some basoseptal and midseptal dyskinesis, and patchy fibrosis of the septum and papillary muscles of the heart. She also had a whole body PET scan that showed no myocardial uptake. All right, Austin, any thoughts here on this patient now that you have more information?
Okay, yeah, a lot's happened, some of which was stuff that I suspected actually earlier. So I'll describe kind of what's happened to this woman. So because she's having exertional symptoms at home, and we have not yet seen anything else going on, we should exert her and see what happens. And so that is what the stress test was for. So during the stress test, she showed us that she had some abnormal heart rhythms that happened. And so this is kind of in line with what I was mentioning earlier, as far as my concern, for example, around her heart rate of 50, even though she was on a beta blocker, but knowing that sarcoidosis can sometimes involve the heart and the conduction system and can lead to problems like this, perhaps she's having something like that going on here. The fact that she had a quote-unquote self-limited run of polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, this is getting into a little bit more advanced stuff for our audience, but this is a very dangerous heart rhythm. And polymorphic ventricular tachycardia comes in a couple different flavors. It can happen if you are having ischemic heart disease, for example, like a heart attack. It can also happen for other reasons, relating to other kind of more nuanced aspects of cardiac conduction that I'm happy to teach to people who want to have a more detailed understanding, but I'll bypass that for now. But it can sometimes happen for genetic reasons, due to electrolyte problems, due to medications, various things. So I'm very suspicious now, even more than I was before, of her having an electrical problem leading to the symptoms she's been experiencing. And so next, the coronary angiogram that was redone, again, to look for evidence of, for example, heart attack or ischemic heart disease going on, which was reassuring that she's not having that. Next, they described this abnormal heart rhythm that she was having while being monitored in the hospital, which is exactly what I would have recommended or done in this situation. And they describe a particular rhythm that, for the medical students in the audience, kind of this intermittent blocking of conduction between the atria and the ventricles, prolonging of the PR interval, is kind of a classic Mobitz type scenario, where she is having a progressively prolonging PR interval and then dropping a beat, if I'm understanding what was going on correctly. So that would be a Mobitz 1 type pattern. And so the concern that I have in this situation is that she has something going on in her heart muscle, and in her heart muscle is extending and impacting the function of the electrical wiring and causing the heart to be irritable and leading to these abnormal heart rhythms when she exerts herself and leading to the symptoms of shortness of breath. And again, this can tie back to sarcoidosis, but there are other things that can infiltrate, get into the heart muscle, interfere with its function in this way. And so that's what the cardiac MRI was for. The cardiac MRI showing this evidence of fibrosis in the heart muscle and a little bit of a reduction in her ejection fraction. So this opens up the differential diagnosis of all the different things that can cause fibrosis in the heart muscle, which I will, again, probably not go into extensive detail on those on. And that's not something that I'm evaluating on a very routine basis. But sarcoidosis, again, can totally do that. As far as the PET scan, though, PET scan then showing no uptake of tracer. So what is a PET scan? A PET scan is a fancy kind of CT where they give a radio-labeled glucose a molecule to the patient, and you basically see what cells of the body are taking that up and metabolizing it. So areas that are hypermetabolic, for example, from cancer, will take up that glucose and it will light up on a PET scan. And so the question here is, when you do this PET scan, are you seeing uptake in the heart muscle in the spot where that patchy fibrosis was, which can potentially narrow your differential diagnosis from there. In some situations and in some very advanced centers, they will actually do myocardial biopsies, go in and take a piece, but that is obviously a pretty high risk procedure. But sometimes it's absolutely necessary, and especially necessary if you have a patient who's in really rough shape, somebody who's actively dying from certain conditions like giant cell myocarditis and various other things that are really life-threatening and also really hard to diagnose, they might go in and take a piece. And so that would be, you know, this is well beyond the territory of a general internist like me, but recognizing and understanding this process of workup, I would be getting to this point and certainly speaking with a cardiologist, both from the electrophysiology side, what is the electrical problem that we're trying to solve here, but also do we need to get tissue? Do we need to get a biopsy piece of something to prove? Does the testing that we have so far look like sarcoidosis infiltrating the heart, or is there something else getting into the heart that is causing this? For example, she is a bit on the older side for this, but there are certain kind of genetic cardiomyopathies that can present similarly, and various other conditions, again, that I'll spare the audience for now. But that would be kind of where I'm at. Some sort of infiltrative cardiac disorder, for example, sarcoidosis. The question being, does this patient need a biopsy, or can we diagnose it based on imaging here or any other features that we have available to us? And I would be looking up, because off the top of my head, I don't know whether I would expect cardiac sarcoidosis to light up on a PET scan or not. That would be something I'd be searching, because I don't do that every day.
Hey, everyone. I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. I just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Factor. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The days are getting shorter, but your to-do lists aren't. So instead of reaching for your phone to order out or heading to the nearest restaurant, let Factor help you take the stress out of healthy eating this winter. You can skip the grocery stores, the prep work, cooking fatigue, etc., and instead get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including everything from vegan to high-protein options and everything in between. They've got guilt-free comfort foods like homestyle chicken and gravy and loaded mashed potato pork chops, feel-good vegan options like sweet potato and chickpea curry, and gourmet plus dishes like truffle butter filet mignon. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change up your order every week. You could pause or reschedule whenever you want. And check this out, Factor is cheaper than takeout, and that's definitely important heading into this holiday season. Now, if you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head over to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up, and according to the 2022 Annual Data Breach Report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the U.S. in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. This podcast is sponsored by Masterclass. For a gift that's always on time and lasts a lifetime, you can't do better than Masterclass. With Masterclass, you can learn from the best to become your best. You guys are wondering who my dream mentor is? It's probably Neil deGrasse Tyson for scientific communication or Mark Cuban on business. And I was really excited when I heard that they both have classes on Masterclass. Masterclass is the only streaming platform where you can learn and grow with over 200 of the world's top experts. And this holiday season, don't just give your loved ones something that they want, give them something that they want to be. With Masterclass, they can finally become a better cook, writer, entrepreneur, or an artist like they've always wanted. Whatever you choose, it's hard to go wrong with Masterclass. Plus, there's no risk. Every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Give your loved ones a year of learning with Masterclass. Now, Masterclass always has great offers during the holidays, sometimes as much as up to 50% off. You can head over to masterclass.com/BBM for their current offer. That's up to 50% off at masterclass.com/BBM. That's masterclass.com/BBM.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this is the extent of the testing and workup that this patient subsequently had prior to diagnosis, because the cardiology team was more intimately familiar with the diagnostic guidelines of the particular diagnosis that this patient has. So unfortunately, Dr. Baraki, I can't provide you with additional – you can't phone a friend and me be the friend in this particular case. So you're charged with coming up with a diagnosis based on, I assume, exclusion and also the pertinent information that you've been provided with so far. So what is your diagnosis for this particular individual?
Yikes. Yeah, this is something that I don't believe I'll be able to fully diagnose. So I'd be basically framing this as a case of the patient having exertional dyspnea due to exertional likely arrhythmias from a infiltrative cardiomyopathy. That would be kind of like the way that I'd be framing this problem and kind of looking into the list of possible diagnoses and which of those can apparently be made non-invasively, meaning without a biopsy. There are, again, a variety of these things, like Fabry's disease and a whole bunch of other things that can get into the heart and also involve other organs. And that's, I think, one of the other aspects that's been challenging here is I've not really heard any evidence of other organ involvement in this patient. You mentioned this issue in the lung and then something in the heart, but sometimes other things can involve the blood vessels elsewhere, the skin, the kidneys, the liver, things like that. So I would be at a point where short of getting tissue in this patient, I'd be having a tough time getting much closer to a diagnosis unless I'm just trying to think out loud here. Could this be something infectious? Could this be something else autoimmune? Could it be something other than sarcoidosis going on in there? That was a misdiagnosis that was assumed based on her hyaluronopathy, but she actually has something other than sarcoidosis. That's a possibility. Could it be something malignant like lymphoma that is getting into her heart muscle? Several of these things are theoretically possible, short of tissue. Again, when I think about some of the other inflammatory cardiomyopathies, she's not really acting like that. She's not acting like fulminant myocarditis, no fevers, nothing else. So yeah, I'm kind of at a dead end here without tissue or some more evidence. That would be my question for a consultant. So yeah.
There you go. Well, the diagnosis that they came up with was cardiac sarcoidosis with pulmonary sarcoidosis in remission. But ultimately, this cardiac sarcoidosis caused torsades de pointes and subsequent symptoms that you described with the shortness of breath on exertion and such. So you were there. You should have
so just, what's cardiac sarcoidosis?
Yeah. You should have just committed. And honestly, like when I was reading through this, I was like, how did they make that diagnosis without either a tissue biopsy or like it wasn't clear to me kind of how they ended up coming with this clinical diagnosis, but in fact, they did provide a reference to, this sort of diagnostic pathways. So just as you mentioned, you can get a cardiac biopsy specimen that demonstrates the characteristic histological findings. That basically means what it looks like under a microscope, or you can do a clinical diagnosis and there are major and minor criteria and you have to meet a certain amount of them. And she does meet those criteria for this clinical diagnosis of cardiac sarcoidosis. So you were there. In fact, I think I'm going to give you full credit for this and say that my initial prediction was wrong. But ultimately, if you are not familiar with that sort of algorithm for how the diagnostic process works for cardiac sarcoidosis, and why would you? Because this is such a zebra in, for you to particularly work up on your own without a consultant, be unlikely for you to do that. But how did this patient do? Well, she had a double chamber implantable cardiac defibrillator placed for secondary prevention. And the patient was also started on a steroid, methylprednisolone, and also methotrexate. Subsequent interrogation of her ICD, that implanted device, showed episodes of non-sustained VTAC that were asymptomatic. And she actually had one discharge in the 12-month follow-up. But ultimately, she did well, was able to return to exercise, and subsequently was monitored for any further sequelae. So I wanted to talk a little bit about sarcoidosis. I wanted to talk a little bit about cardiac sarcoidosis. And then further, maybe more importantly to our audience, is like, look, if you have a client with sarcoidosis, you hear that, you ask what sort of medical conditions they have, like, can they exercise? That's, I think, a more important takeaway for our non-clinical audience here. So first off, what is sarcoidosis? Austin, I don't know how many times you're seeing like undifferentiated, like new diagnoses of sarcoidosis, but it's probably always in the differential early on. Mm-hmm. If people have watched House, for example, they say, lupus, it could always be lupus. Well, same sort of thing. It could like always be sarcoidosis because it can do so many different things. How do you characterize this to patients when you say the word sarcoidosis? How do you describe this to them?
Yeah, it's a pretty uncommon condition, but I do see it a handful of times a year, and sometimes it's a new diagnosis, sometimes it's a known diagnosis. It's a condition where you get these collections of inflammatory cells called granulomas, and they can be present in different tissues throughout the body. Most commonly, it affects the lungs, but it can also affect, like I said, the skin, it can affect the heart, it can affect the liver, it can affect the nervous system, the brain, all sorts of different tissues can be impacted. It's quite difficult to definitively diagnose in a lot of situations. The classic scenario is what you described of her having these kind of nodes in her lungs that light up. But even then, that same thing, you can get that from tuberculosis, you can get it from fungal infections, you can get it from a bunch of other things. So the diagnosis of it is, there's several, as you said, relatively strict criteria to make a diagnosis of sarcoidosis. Now, again, during that case, from the moment I heard a heart rate of 50 in a patient with sarcoidosis, my brain immediately went to, could she have cardiac sarcoidosis screwing with her electrical conduction system? Because that is actually a situation that I do see and is something that clearly is that much of a knee-jerk reflex for me of like heart block from sarcoid, right? Or any kind of arrhythmia from sarcoid, which is ultimately what she ended up having. The challenge, though, is making that leap. And that leap is not something that a generalist would make. It would be in collaboration with subspecialists for sure, because sarcoidosis is something that can mimic a lot of other conditions, and a lot of other conditions can mimic sarcoidosis. And so to summarize, yeah, you get these just inflammatory lumps and of cells that can impact organ function throughout the body. And when it gets into the heart, and definitely when it gets into the brain, it can cause pretty devastating consequences.
Yep. Yeah. So to summarize, sarcoidosis is this multi-system inflammatory disorder that can prevent in a variety of different ways. We don't really know what causes it at the time of this recording, though there does seem to be a number of occupational, environmental, and infectious triggers that can spur the disease to progress in those who have a genetic susceptibility to it. Again, as you mentioned, it's characterized by these granulomas, specifically non-caseating granulomas in the affected tissues. So basically, certain types of white blood cells wall off this inflammatory reaction, and non-caseating means that there's not necrotic or dead tissue in the middle of it, whereas a caseating granuloma does tend to have dead or necrotic tissue in it that apparently has a cheesy consistency. Which not sure I'm going to look at cheese or casein the same way again after this particular podcast, but that was interesting to learn. It may occur at all ages and presents with lung involvement in about 90% of cases. So that seems to be the most common organ system that it can affect. But there are plenty of extra pulmonary or things outside the respiratory system where sarcoidosis can have manifestations. So things like the joints, kidney, liver, eyes, nervous system, skin, even though there's a specific musculoskeletal one called Lofgren's syndrome, and also the heart, as in this case. In the United States, systemic sarcoidosis has a prevalence of about 35.2 cases per 100,000 persons, which has a predilection towards the East Coast in urban areas. It's higher in women than men. But cardiac sarcoidosis is much more rare and does tend to vary in geographical location. Japan, for example, has a really high rate of cardiac sarcoidosis, for example. And in fact, they published one of the guidelines on like diagnostics for this. So cardiac sarcoidosis is an infiltrative cardiomyopathy, that is a disease that affects the heart muscle that results from those granulomas and the inflammation going on inside those granulomas in the heart muscle, the myocardium. So common presentations include this conduction disease, so a problem in the electrical system. You can get ventricular arrhythmias from that, or left ventricular dysfunction, or all of it. And there's a range of severity from like asymptomatic conduction abnormalities to fatal arrhythmias. Mm-hmm. Ventricular tachycardia is the most common reported arrhythmia, so again, secondary to those granulomas. And ejection fraction, which is something we mentioned a few times, is the most important predictor of mortality in cardiac sarcoidosis, apparently. So it was reassuring that her ejection fraction was like not, you know, 5 or 10%.
Yes.
But yeah, it'd have been interesting to know, like, did she have one previously done? And is this a decline for her? Is that why she's getting this dyspnea? Or was it the torsades? Me trying to describe torsades in a way where I didn't say torsades also was problematic. I was like, I just want to call it torsades, but then I got to explain the whole thing, what's going on. And you're like, yeah. Hey man, slow it down. So yeah. Effectively, again, this can be diagnosed histologically. So take a sample of the heart, which I actually wonder what would have triggered them to do so, given that there are sort of diagnostic criteria for cardiac sarcoidosis. I suspect if she had been either more symptomatic or like crumping, you know, going downhill quickly, they probably would have just done it. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, yes. The fact that, I mean, you didn't tell me how she was diagnosed with the pulmonary sarcoidosis before, so I was just trusting you on that. But there are a lot of scenarios where people come in with that supposed diagnosis and it is incorrect. And so that's why I was entertaining the possibility that, gosh, this really seems like cardiac sarcoid, but maybe if they were wrong before, they could be wrong now. But if that was proven, then your probability of sarcoidosis also involving the heart is really high, and you can be more confident and get away with doing it without a biopsy. The scenarios where a cardiac biopsy, at least that I've seen, have actually happened, are those ultra high risk patients. You have somebody who is having what we would call like fulminant myocarditis, for example, and you want to get to the bottom of that diagnosis. Is it something due to an infection? Is it an autoimmune condition like lymphocytic myocarditis, giant cell myocarditis, those things that are really, really, really difficult to diagnose non-invasively, and those patients can die really quickly. So that's a different type of scenario altogether. Here, this was they had a little bit more time to get to the bottom of it. And with the previous diagnosis, it's like, well, yeah, she checks all these boxes, so that's a good enough for us.
Yeah. So now I wanted to talk about exercise for sarcoidosis. I was actually hopeful that there'd be like a bunch of guidelines or RCT, you know, randomized controlled trials where that people, you know, did exercise when they had a diagnosis of sarcoidosis, and you saw, you know, massive improvements in their function or quality of life or whatever. I was somewhat disappointed, although I did find a few papers. All of these are linked in the description below, where people shared my sentiment that they were frustrated that why hasn't this been studied further? And they made some accusations of like researchers and other expert consensus stuff that has been previously delivered, where effectively they were telling folks not to exercise, particularly if they had cardiac sarcoidosis. You know, it's the same thing we saw with like cardiomyopathy and other certain heart diseases where they're in myocarditis. They're like, hey, just don't exercise. And it's like, well, we know that there are risks to being insufficiently active, and the risk of exercising with these conditions is not really well characterized. So where does that sort of – how does that calculus shake out? So in sarcoidosis, fatigue is a very common symptom of the disease, and most it's the most common symptom as well, affecting the majority of patients with sarcoidosis. Despite that, it still remains poorly understood. The influence of exercise capacity and muscle strength on this fatigue that people with sarcoidosis have has not been studied extensively in sarcoidosis, although reduced exercise capacity and general weakness are frequently reported symptoms. Patients with fatigue complaints are also more likely to report problems with exercise intolerance compared to non-fatigued patients. Some interesting data here. They're using tests like this 6-minute walk test. So basically, how far can you walk in 6 minutes? A hand grip strength test where they do that, you know, you squeeze as hard as you can on a dynamometer. Isometric testing of the elbow flexors, for example, the biceps. Same thing with lower extremity strength testing. So those with fatigue, with sarcoidosis, tend to have a more marked decrease in performance on all these tests. So they don't walk as far. Their hand grip strength is compromised more. Their isometric strength of their biceps are also reduced. But it's still reduced compared to normal healthy individuals in those with sarcoidosis as well, but no fatigue. So it's like even if you're asymptomatic but have the diagnosis of sarcoidosis, it seems like if you're not exercising, you do seem to have higher levels of fatigue, poorer performance on functional testing as well, which makes a case for like, yeah, we should probably have these patients exercise, not only to like shore up any sort of some, you know, this functional stuff, but maybe it reduces the fatigue and improves quality of life. So in saying that, the one study that I really liked basically surveyed all of the world's leading sarcoidosis experts. You know, power of the internet, you can access all these people, send them an email. They had a pretty good response rate. About 80% of the folks that they contacted responded. So ultimately ended up being 165 of the world's leading sarcoidosis experts. Most of them were pulmonologists, about 82%. And nearly all of them, close to 90%, rated physical training as highly valuable in those with sarcoidosis. Only 3% considered it not valuable, and these respondents indicated being unfamiliar with physical training and exercise in sarcoidosis, which kind of makes sense. So the idea here is to achieve improvement of sarcoidosis-associated fatigue, exercise should be recommended in both symptomatic sarcoidosis patients, so those with fatigue, and also those who are asymptomatic as well. Generally, most of these experts recommend supervised exercise, and that's a question I actually have for you, because they don't recommend any specific monitoring or like specific things to look out for supervision. So I'm kind of wondering, like, is this more of a CYA thing, like cover your butt? We're like, oh yeah, do supervised exercise, because they assume that that's happening in like a clinical facility, and maybe those folks are more well trained on what to look for if something's going wrong. Or do you think that's just like a, I don't know, they recommended it for some other reason?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a stock catchphrase in these kind of things. I don't see a specific reason for supervision. I think the highest risk scenario for unsupervised exercise would be if you have known cardiac sarcoidosis and are trying to exercise and you don't have a defibrillator. But you shouldn't be doing that in that situation. If you have cardiac sarcoidosis with known ventricular arrhythmias, you won't be exercising until you get a defibrillator placed, because that's the thing that'll save your life. So I don't think, I don't know that I would agree that, you know, all of their, because then it's like, what counts as exercise and what doesn't? Can they take a walk by themselves?
Totally.
You know,
so can they garden? Can they, right. Yeah, put dishes away, whatever. Can, you know, vigorous feline, you know, cat playing with, sure. Like, can they do that?
Yeah.
So they do mention most of the experts recommended a relative contraindication if somebody had a pulmonary hypertension with their sarcoidosis and or cardiac involvement. And in that case, they recommend this shared decision making. And they cite the position statement of the sports cardiology section of the European Association for Preventive Cardiology. And they have this sort of laundry list of, like, how would a clinician come to the shared decision making with the patient, which I actually found pretty awesome. It's a pretty good read. It's also linked in the description below. So if you have a client with sarcoidosis or somebody with, you know, some sort of cardiac disease and their doctor told them that they can't exercise, it might be useful to review this guideline. Because effectively, they go through a bunch of different cases where it was previously thought that these folks could not exercise without undue risk. And they're like, well, it's actually been studied. And maybe the risk is less than we thought. There was a specific call out. I wish I would have pulled the quote, but it was like, we should avoid sports and activities that place a high degree or high importance on excellence and performance. And I was like, oh, I like that quite well. You know, yeah, I mean, I can imagine a scenario where somebody's incentivized where they have to perform at the highest level, that might incur some undue risk. But exercise in general, that'd be a pretty tough ask to say, you can't exercise or be active at all. Because again, as you said, what counts as exercise? And then lastly, they recommend training effectively the same as the current guidelines. So some muscle strengthening activities and some conditioning exercise. So how does that practically apply here? They also further reference additional guidelines on chronic lung disease. So to include things like COPD, for example, interstitial lung disease and so on, other chronic respiratory diseases, which also includes pulmonary sarcoidosis. The only difference between this and the current exercise guidelines, as we've repeated so many times, which are, you know, do some conditioning about 2.5 hours a week or more total, and lift weights to hit all the major muscle groups twice per week or more. They recommend that, look, if somebody has shortness of breath for these long, steady state cardio bouts, you can do intervals. And I was like, oh, nice. This is like one of the first intelligent use cases for intervals I've seen in a medical situation. So they recommend to basically assess, can a person do the conditioning you're asking of them? If they can't, consider doing some interval training. It doesn't necessarily mean high intensity interval training. It just means like breaking up the bout. They also recommend to get some data at the beginning of this to sort of monitor how a patient is doing it more objectively. So a 6-minute walk test, for example, they think can be useful. Some low stakes, low skill strength testing. So that might be something like a leg extension. It might be something like a curl, preacher curl, for example, just to see like what's the current strength. I doubt that most trainers have access to a hand grip strength dynamometer, and I don't know that that's the best test of functional strength either. And then they also recommend using this fatigue assessment scale. It's a 10-item test. It's freely available on the internet. You can basically say, oh, when you started, before you were exercising regularly, your fatigue was generally this. And now, you know, a few months later, it's this. So there's some improvement there. But yeah, it's the same guidelines we've been recommending to the general populace, just with the sort of option to do some intermittent intervals training instead of the moderate intensity continuous training. There was also this thought like, look, if a person is up for it, you can actually take their muscle strengthening exercise all the way to failure, which says to me like they're not really worried about any sort of cardiorespiratory response to resistance training or even like intensity related stuff. They're like, yeah, 8 to 15 reps, sure, send it. Go all the way to failure if they can tolerate it. And it's like, okay. Well, I like the aggressive position, but also makes me feel better about suggesting that folks with sarcoidosis, whether it's systemic or whether it has other sort of spread or tissue involvement, that they could probably exercise on some level.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think that the cardiac sarcoid would be the highest risk situation, particularly if they have issues with their electrical conduction system. And then, yeah, the question is just, do they have a defibrillator or not? Slash, have, like, what was the reason that that was diagnosed? In other words, did they pass out with exercise? Did they have known arrhythmias? Like, that's the high risk situation for exercise. But short of that, if you have it in your lungs, there's not anything catastrophic that I'm worried about you doing. If you have, you know, other organ involvement, skin involvement, whatever. Yeah, I would not have any reservations about those folks exercising either.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is one of those cases where you definitely would want to get the physician's sort of sign off that, hey, this patient's clear to exercise. I do think that sharing with them some of the current guidelines on, like, shared decision making and current exercise guidelines may be useful if they're not up on that particular information. But yeah, ultimately, that's a conversation that the patient is going to have with their provider. And you would basically kind of take the doctor's advice and recommendation at face value, because if you're a trainer, coach, overriding that opens yourself up, I think, to some unwanted liability. I don't know. How, off the top, and you know, I know you how you love questions that you're unprepared, you know, to answer. Can you imagine a scenario where a doctor would recommend against exercise for somebody? And then, like, what would you do? What would you recommend as far as, like, trying to see, is that really, like, the death sentence for them with respect to exercise? Like, when do you recommend, like, a second opinion, for example, or for somebody to go out on their own and say, ah, I hear what you're saying, doc, but I'm going to do this other thing?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to ask the physician making that recommendation, like, what's the worst case scenario that you're worried about from this? And then it's actually never wrong to get another opinion if you want one. There's no guarantee the second opinion is going to be any better than the first one, or it could be worse. But I actually never really would advise patients against getting a second opinion if they want it. There are a couple cardiac conditions where, yes, the correct recommendation is, unfortunately, this sucks, you should not exercise. And that is actually a longer term limitation that is set on patients. Very unfortunate conditions that people can have where that is, in fact, the recommendation. This is not one of them that we talked about today. But if you had one of those conditions, you would definitely want to get that correct recommendation and have it validated.
Yeah. No, good advice. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on episode 320, Mystery Case. Turns out to be cardiac sarcoidosis. A special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us on this podcast and sharing with us his clinical knowledge. Before you guys go anywhere, though, leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context switching that can distract employees and costs your company. Luckily, Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to crank out clear, on-brand emails, documents, messages, and more. In just one click, they can go from blank page to first draft, all without leaving the page they're on. Grammarly has 15 years of experience building effective, secure AI that can be implemented in days with minimal IT overhead. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences, whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise-ready AI.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10-plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite-level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.